In our series called Counterculture, and every week we've been talking about what it looks like to follow Jesus in the culture that we're in. We want to be disciples of Jesus, which means we want to follow Jesus and be formed into the image of Jesus. We want our lives to look more like Jesus. But the reality is that we are also in a culture, and in our culture, there are other things that are shaping us besides Jesus and the gospel. There are other things that are making us, calling us to follow them instead of Jesus. There are other things discipling us rather than just Jesus. So to really follow Jesus intentionally, we have to not only seek to follow him, but sometimes we also have to look at how the call of Jesus is counter to these other calls on our lives, these other ways of living that are saying, come live this way. This is the way to live. And we have to push back against those things often with the gospel. All kinds of things shaping our hearts and thoughts and minds. It's not always making us look more like Jesus. What are those things shaping our heart more than the gospel? We have to be aware of them. We have to push back against them. And in our culture, I think that there are very few things valued more than freedom, right? When a pop star sings the national anthem, that's the word that we want them to hold out the longest, right? It's the land of the free. I mean, it's the home of the brave too, but that's sort of just an add-in, right? Freedom is the thing that we're really excited about. Freedom to live how we please. To do what we like, to pursue what makes each one of us happy, to pursue our own definition of the good life. And in general, we don't believe in our culture that anyone really has the right to tell us how to live because we're free. And we shouldn't criticize the way that another person lives because we each all have the right to live on our own terms. That's what it means to be free. And in light of that culture, I want you to just hear these words from Psalm 119, which were probably written by David. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because this is actually the longest chapter in the entire Bible. And this chapter, the longest chapter in the whole Bible, is literally a love song to God's law and rules. Just hear these words and how countercultural they really are. I'm going to read from verse 44 in Psalm 119. David says, "I will keep your law continually, forever and ever, and I shall walk in a wide place, for I have sought your precepts. I will also speak of your testimonies before kings and shall not be put to shame, for I find my delight in your commandments, which I love. I will lift up my hands towards your commandments, which I love, and I will meditate on your statutes." Skipping down to verse 64, he writes, "The earth, O Lord, is full of your steadfast love. Teach me your statutes." In verse 68, he says, "You are good and you do good. Teach me your statutes." And in verse 73, he says, "Your hands have made me and fashioned me. Give me understanding that I may learn your commandments." This is God's word. Now this is, if we're honest with ourselves, an amazing and a strange psalm. This goes on for 176 verses like this, right? I love your law. I love your rules. Teach me your statutes. Give me more precepts, rules. These are amazing, right? And I know this is the Bible, so you expect stuff like this. But just let's remember that the person who wrote this was a human, no different from the rest of us. And yet it seems like he thinks so differently from the way that we think, right? I mean, maybe we sort of begrudgingly accept the reality of rules and commandments as necessary, but who here has ever written a love song to commandments, right? Who has loved laws and commandments so much that you literally go on and on for 176 verses about how amazing they are? I mean, our culture, we do the exact opposite thing. We write love songs to our own authority and freedom and autonomy to make our own way in the world, right? Songs like Frank Sinatra's My Way, right? We love this song. "For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not. To say the things he truly feels and not the words of one who kneels. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way." I mean, that's the kind of song that we want to write that stirs our hearts. And it's a total contrast to David, who's just totally submitted to God's commandments and laws and rules. I mean, David's words are definitely the words of one who kneels. He kneels. And it sounds so limiting and constraining, if we're honest. It sounds stifling to us. In our culture, there's really only one authority that each of us is trained to fully embrace and love, and that is our own authority, right? We live like we're our own primary authority. I was watching Moana with my son the other day for about the eighth time. And a line jumped out at me. And I'm not trashing this movie. I know I picked on Trolls a few weeks ago. And honestly, both of those are pretty good movies. Judah, I know, loves them. But one of the great reasons that I think children's movies often make really helpful illustrations is that if you want to see what your culture really values, the morality of the culture around you, just listen to what your culture is telling children, right? The kind of stories that our culture is telling our children really shows the cultural values that we live in. And the other reason I think that I use kids' movie illustrations is that those are basically the only movies that I get to watch anymore. That's it. So those are the only illustrations I can use. But Moana, of course, she's got this adventurous spirit, you know, and she feels drawn to the open sea. But her father, her authority figure, says, no, we stay on the island, right? That's who you are. We're island people. We don't go past the reef. We don't go into the sea. That's the commandment. This is my authority. This is who you are. You're an island person. Don't go to the sea. But her heart is telling her something else, right? Her heart is calling her away from her father's authority. And of course, if there's anything that we've learned from Disney, it's that you've got to follow your heart, right? I mean, this is the value of our culture. If this movie was made 100 years ago, the moral of the story would be, obey your dad, stay on the island, right? And bad things will happen to you if you disobey. But now, of course, the moral is, no, follow your heart. Go where your heart's calling you. And then towards the end of the movie, and I almost missed this line because it's actually in a boring part that Judah usually wants me to skip. He's like, fast forward this part, Dad. I want to see the lava monster, right? And but it's in those boring talking parts where you learn the moral of the story, right? You see the worldview behind the story. And so one of the characters is discouraged because he feels like a failure. He doesn't feel like he's discovering his true purpose. He's not who he's meant to be. And Moana puts her hand on his shoulder and she says to him, because he feels like he's letting down the gods, okay? It's a pagan sort of thing. Anyway, so she says to him, she says, the gods aren't the ones who make you who you are. You are, right? That's what she said. She said, don't worry. Like, just follow your heart. The gods aren't the ones who decide who you are. Maui, you are, right? In other words, your destiny is in your hands. Follow your heart. Look inside, and you'll find out who you're meant to be. The real authority is not outside of you, it's inside of you, and that's the message of our culture. Don't boycott Moana, okay? If you boycott Moana, you're gonna have to boycott everything because that's what our culture is telling us. Our culture says, if you wanna find out what's true, if you wanna find out who you really are, look inside of you. Charles Taylor, a Christian sociologist, pointed out that we have moved over time from a culture of authority to a culture of authenticity. In a culture of authority, everyone recognized and submitted to outside authorities, such as the king or their parents or the church or God. We see the authority as outside of us, but in a culture of authenticity, the most important thing is to be true to yourself, to be authentic. There's still authority, but that authority is located in our own self. In a culture of authenticity, the greatest sin is not disobeying an authority outside of you. It's to fail to be true to your authentic self and also to try to tell anyone else that they can't be who they really are, their authentic self. And each of us get to determine what our lives should really be like. And the thing we really don't want is anyone else telling us what our life should be like, how we should behave, you know, whether or not we should be consumers, right? How we should, you know, go and live for the sake of it. We don't want somebody else telling us how we should live, how we should use our sexuality or how we should spend our money, all these different things. It's sort of like mind your own, right? And we don't want anyone certainly telling us that our life choices are sinful. That actually, in order to live the life that we are meant to live, we may have to actually deny ourselves. If you do actually say to someone, hey, actually, you know, life is meant to be lived this way, then someone might say to you, listen, that might be true for you, but that's not true for me, right? In order to be true to myself. One writer said, our culture considers personal experience the ultimate authority, which is why my experience has been shorthanded to my truth. Right? You've got to live out your truth. Maybe your truth says that you should live that way, but my truth is different from that. If we're our own authorities, then we're defining truth for ourselves, and we don't want truth imposed on us. We decide what's true for us based on our experience. And so that's what our culture says. And if you just look at what we just read, it really could not be more different from what we see David saying in this psalm in Psalm 119. So what does David see that we're missing? Why does it sound so stifling and horrible to us to give up our autonomy and freedom and to be under God's authority and his rules? But David, when he saw it, he didn't just say, okay, I'll do it. He saw it as with joy, and he sang about it with poetry. It was like a man who had just fallen in love encountering the commands of God. What's the difference here? And I think we see one of the first reasons in verse 73, where David says, your hands have made me and fashioned me. Give me understanding that I may learn your commandments. So first of all, it's because God's authority, David saw that God's authority is what we were created for. David points to the fact that he was put together by God as a creator, and that was the driving force that wanted him to be submitted to God's commandments and authority. And I think that one of the reasons that our culture is becoming more and more convinced that each of us has to determine meaning for ourselves is that we've lost the belief that we have a creator who has created us a specific way with a specific purpose. So most of us have vehicles, and hopefully you maintain your vehicles. If you own a car, I'm not always the best at this because life can be busy. And honestly, you know, I know that I'm meant to get an oil change every, 3 months or, 5,000 miles or something like that. But let's be honest, that is a very stifling and constraining rule, okay? Like, who are you to tell me what to do anyway? I mean, who has time to just drop everything and go sit in a waiting room while people work on your car, and you know they're just gonna come back in and they coincidentally found like 14 things that are wrong with it that you've gotta fix right then and there, or else it's gonna be a total disaster, right? So, you know, I'd rather skip oil changes. I really would. But all of us hopefully know that car manufacturers don't tell us to get oil changes because they have a sadistic desire to watch us squirm in the waiting room, right? It's what's best for the car. That's what's best for the car. Eventually, if you never do it, your engine will just die, or maybe it'll blow up. I don't really know a lot about cars. I sort of picture that it blows up and just sort of a fireball, right? I don't know what'll happen. I don't wanna know what's gonna happen. If you resisted getting an oil change in the name of your freedom and autonomy from the rules, right? You know, freedom from the waiting room, freedom from bills, freedom from you telling me what I should do with my car. What you will actually discover is that when you don't have a car anymore, you have a heap of ashes, you've actually lost your freedom. You've lost your ability to go to drive to work and drop your kids off at school. And so we could say, you know, listen, I don't actually feel like getting an oil change. And anyway, you're not the boss of me, so don't tell me how to live. But that's crazy. No, we say, okay, I don't really get it, but you know what? You guys made the car, and the manufacturer recommends every 3 months or 5,000 miles, you designed it. You know how it works better than I do. You know what's going to make that car flourish. And so I'm going to go ahead and listen to the manufacturer. We only actually experience true freedom with our cars when we honor the design of the car and the designer of the car. And in the same way, we only experience true freedom in our lives when we honor our design and the way that God made us and created us. And, you know, if we say, man, it seems like God's commands are so limiting, right? They're stifling. They permit me from doing certain things that I would really like to do, like, for instance, sleeping with who I want to sleep with, which would be nice, or, cheating on my taxes, which I'd really like to do. That would be really helpful for my bottom line, or lying to my spouse, which I'd like to do. That would save me from all kinds of headaches. But God's rules don't let me do any of those things. But when you see what David saw, you'd see that God's commands aren't arbitrary, right? They're not random. He's not just the fun police, like, oh yeah, these four things you'd really enjoy and they'd be really helpful. No, you can't do them. No, there's design and purpose and intentionality. And we see in this passage as well then that these commands then are for our good and flourishing. He says this is an amazing statement. In verse 44, David says, just picture yourself saying this, I will keep your law continually forever and ever, and I shall walk in a wide place. What a crazy thing to say. To keep your law continually forever and ever, that sounds exhausting and confining and limiting and life squashing. But he says, only then if I do that will I walk in a wide place. Will my life be expansive and big and liberating and joy-giving? In our culture, freedom is the ability to do whatever we want. But in the Bible, true freedom is living the way we were made to live. Living the way we were designed to live. The Bible says God has made you and the world to operate in a certain way. And you're most free when you're living into that created order. So for example, we're told in the Bible we should forgive. And sometimes that doesn't sound nice or easy. Sometimes we don't want to. But if God is our creator and designer, then his command to forgive is not just some random thing that you should probably consider doing because God and everything. No, it's the way that you were made. And when you don't do it, you'll get eaten up by bitterness and cynicism, and your life will be poisoned with a hard heart. Actually, you weren't made to live that way. You were made to live God's way and walk in forgiveness, right? And most of us would probably agree with that one. You're like, yeah, no, I'm forgiveness. That's probably important. I agree, right? Maybe something that tends to hit a little closer to home where we're like, I don't know, does God really have it right on this? Is God's commands about sexuality, right? You know, he says sex, it's a very exclusive thing. It's for a committed marriage relationship of one man and one woman committed for life till death do you part, right? That's what it's for. And that sounds so constraining and restrictive to us. And yet, if we receive this, not as a God who's thinking, how can I squash all their fun down there? I know, I'm gonna make sex, but then I'm gonna basically say, you have to go to the prison of marriage in order to have sex, right? Ha ha, that'll show them. No, actually, this is from a designer with a good plan for how the whole thing works, how your life will flourish, and how your community will flourish, and how the whole world will flourish. To us, sexual sin just doesn't seem that bad, right? We can justify it. We can say like, I mean, why would God really care, you know, up there in heaven? Why would he really care if I just watch a little bit of porn? It's not gonna really hurt anybody. I'm gonna get a little bit of pleasure out of it. What's the big deal? But actually, we know that it is a big deal. Not only does porn negatively affect the brain of the person using it, making it more difficult for them to enjoy real relationships, but it also has impacts outside of the individual. It contributes to the sex trafficking industry. It keeps many other marginalized women trapped in a degrading industry. As we have, as a culture, begun to ignore God's constraints on sexuality, we've found that actually an enormous amount of harm has been done in individual lives, in families, and in entire societies. We can't just ignore God's laws and think that everything will continue to flourish in the same way. And listen, I'm not just telling you this as a pastor with all the answers, okay? I'm telling you this as a fellow sinner. I'm not saying that I've nailed all these commands perfectly and you guys should too, okay? I'm not trying to heap up shame on us for our failures. I'm saying that what we have to do is have David's mindset. When we encounter God's commands, we need to see what David saw. We need to see what David is saying, that when we see God's commands, we have to start with the presupposition that God designed us. He's our creator. He's our manufacturer. And how fruitless would it be, even when it's hard, even when I feel like I'll never be able to do it, how fruitless and futile it would be for us to kick against the way that we're designed in the name of freedom and autonomy and to live life on my terms. By the way, this is actually one of the reasons why it's tempting to just decide maybe we weren't created for a purpose, right? Maybe there is no creator, because if there's no God, if I haven't been created, then I guess I'm just free to live however I want. I can make up my own rules and live on my own terms. No rules about sex or money or forgiveness or any of that. But there's a downside to that, because if there's no designer, then there's no design, right? If there's no creator that created us for a purpose, then, you know, we just came from nothing and we're headed to nothingness. So you removed your creator and now you're free to live how you want. But you know what you no longer have? You no longer have any meaning in life, because if you came from nothingness and you're going to nothingness, it's very difficult to say that your life can really amount to anything. But if God actually did create us, then not only is there real and ultimate meaning and purpose in this world, but it also means that in order to find our true purpose and how we're meant to live, we have to look back to our creator. This is difficult for us because it flies in the face of our autonomy and our desire to rule ourselves. But the second reason we should embrace God's rule for us is that being our own master is actually an impossible illusion. Something that we see in scripture and in life is that we will always have some kind of master. In the Old Testament, there was an amazing moment where God, he was the king of the people of Israel, right? He had led them out of Egypt across the Red Sea, but they didn't like that. They wanted a human king. And it's very interesting because not only do we see that God is grieved that they would reject him as king, but also he wants to warn them that their new plan to have a human king is not gonna be everything that it's cracked up to be. Just really quickly, look at this passage in 1 Samuel 8, where they come to Samuel, who was the judge. And they say, now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the other nations, right? We don't want to be with God as our king. We want to be like the other nations. But the thing displeased Samuel. And when they said, give us a king to judge us, Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done from the day that I have brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. You see what he's saying? They reject God's authority. We want to rule ourselves. Give us a king. And God says, okay, you're going to get what you want, but I'm going to warn you about this guy because it's not going to be all it's cracked up to be. Okay, they choose Saul, right? The best looking, the most attractive, sort of most authoritative guy to be king. But he's a total disappointment, as just about every king is. He becomes a tyrant, and his rule is far more oppressive than God's rule was over them. And here's the moral lesson that I'm pulling out of this, is that if you're not ruled by God, if you're not surrendered to his authority, you're gonna be ruled by something else, and that something is gonna be way worse, more oppressive, right? There's no such thing as having no master. Either God is your master or something else is. I read recently that Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, he had the poem Invictus read as his last will and testament before he was executed by the state for his crimes. It's a famous poem. Some of you may know it. But the end of that poem, this is what it says. Basically, Invictus, it means unconquerable. The idea of the poem is that my soul is unconquerable. I am my own man. And this is how the poem ends. It says, it matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And that was what Timothy McVeigh wanted to be his last sort of resounding cry to the world before he met his end. You know, in other words, it matters not how straight the gate, I put up my fist at the idea of heaven, or how charged with punishments the scroll, I put up my fist at the idea of hell. I'm in charge of my life. I'm the captain of my soul. But I think there's an important irony to be pointed out here. Not only, of course, was McVeigh not free in a physical sense, as he's saying this, he's literally not only in prison, but being killed for his crimes. So, you know, he's totally a prisoner. But when a person like that, so twisted in his sin, I think we know that he wasn't free in a spiritual sense either, right? He was not the captain of his soul. He was a prisoner of an evil ideology. He was a slave to his hatred. He was a slave. He wasn't living free. We talked about idolatry a few weeks ago. We said that we're all worshiping something, right? Even if we don't believe in God, you have to be living for something. You have to give your life to something. You've got to be worshiping something. And if you don't believe in God and his authority and his word, then certainly there's something that you believe is worth living for and worth giving your life to, whether it's your career or your family or a political cause or your own self and your independence and your autonomy. We can be slaves to just about anything. We can be slaves to money. Some of us are mastered by our sex drive, right? We let our sexual appetites drive our decision-making. You know, we say, you can't tell me how to live. I'm free, right? But are you free or are you just a slave to your sexual fantasies? Are they ruling you? Because something is ruling you. Just like the addict who thinks that, you know, he's free, he's living life on his terms. Meanwhile, it's so obvious that he's actually mastered by drugs or alcohol. Whatever it is that we're living for, it constrains us. We're under its authority. And so true freedom is not found by having no master, because there's no such thing as living with no master. You're always going to serve something with your life. If you're not ruled by God, you'll find out what the Israelites found out, that outside of God's authority, our other masters can be cruel slave drivers. So true freedom doesn't come from having no master. True freedom comes from having the right master, the master that when we surrender to his authority, it's good for us. It brings us into that wide place. We experience the life we were meant to live. It brings joy and hope and peace into our lives rather than death and despair. And this is what David found in God. David is a man filled with love, love for God's commandments and for God himself. He rejoices. He sings a love poem to God's rules because in God's and under God's authority, he has not encountered a tyrant. He's encountered a loving Lord worth giving his entire life to. Look what he says in verse 64. It says, the earth, O Lord, is full of your steadfast love. Teach me your statutes. I have seen how great your love is, and as a result, I want to know everything about you. I want to know what your commandments are. You're a beautiful God. Show me how you want me to live. I've seen and tasted your amazing love, and as a result of it, I want to give up my freedom and autonomy. I want to live in a way that pleases you. And the fact is, this is what love always does, right? When we experience love, we surrender our freedom to enter into a loving relationship. If you want to put up your fist and say, I'm going to live on my terms, then you ultimately can't ever have a real loving relationship because love requires surrendering freedom. As Christians, we talk a lot about being in a relationship with God, right? That's something that we say. But for some of us, it's a very wishy-washy thing to say. We kind of mean, I believe some things about God. I have general positive vibes towards God. And when I'm in trouble and I need something, I talk to God. But I don't let God's commands or the Bible get in the way of me basically living my life the way that I want, right? But that's not a real relationship. That's not a real loving relationship because there's no way to be your own authority and be totally free and have a real loving relationship. So for example, many of us are married, right? And I love being married. I love my family. But I also like going to the movies. And when I was single, I could just go to any movie I wanted. I could go to all the superhero movies, and I did. I love them all, right? Mostly the Marvel ones. The DC ones are just a little dark and weird. But, lately it's been a little tough. It's been a little tough to get to all the movies I want to get to, right? Because first of all, my wife does not love superhero movies as much as I do, okay? And so when we have a date night planned, and I'm trying to plan one that she would actually enjoy, if I centered them all on superhero movies, I probably wouldn't get very far, okay? That's not the way to go. So that's the first reason. Second reason is that my three-month-old twins aren't really into superhero movies either. They're not really great at going to the theater just yet, okay? And so when a new movie comes out and I see all my single friends just, opening night without a care in the world, yeah, of course, why would we not go on opening night? Oh yeah, why would we not, yeah? I experience a loss of my freedom. I experience that, right? Because when you enter into a real committed relationship, you enter into obligations that limit your freedom. You can't, those of you who are married, you know this. Maybe you discovered it soon, maybe you discovered it a little later, but you can't just sort of leave work, not text your wife, decide you're gonna go to New Bern and run some errands, maybe go to Chipotle for dinner, grab a beer, and show up at 10 p.m. and you're laughing because you know what happened. Where were you? Why? What's going on? Oh, yeah, I didn't do anything bad. I just went and I just did my own thing. I'm a person, right? No, you're not just your own person anymore, right? Here's the thing. I've been married for, going on 7 years. I don't make any decisions by myself anymore, okay? Because my decisions aren't about me anymore, right? And we recognize that that's worth it, okay? I'm not autonomous and free, but I wouldn't want to live my life without my loving relationships, right? It's worth laying down some of your freedoms to enter into real loving relationships. And in fact, the more intimate and deep and connected a relationship is, the more we give up our independence. And we're okay with that because actually giving up our independence and beginning to order our lives around these other people, that's what it means to have a real meaningful relationship. Now, how much more with the living God? How much more with God? And when you fall in love and you say, this girl is amazing. Now, just tell me what you're like, babe. I want to find out what you're like and what you like to do so that I can begin to adjust my life around yours, so that I can plan the kind of date nights that you like. I want to find out what your commandments are, what your precepts are. Tell me more. How much more when we meet God and we say, you're amazing. Your steadfast love is amazing. Tell me what you are like. Tell me what you want. Tell me what your desires are so that I can adjust my life to you. To encounter God in any kind of real way, to have a real relationship with God, is to reorder your life around his reality and his expectations, and that's the only way to have a real relationship with him. There were some men in a movie once who didn't like this sort of sacrificial idea of love and marriage. The men of Stepford, Connecticut. Anybody see the movie The Stepford Wives? I actually didn't. I know what it's about. They didn't like the fact that their wives had opinions, and those opinions weren't always their opinions, and they were demanding. They were people, right? And what they really wanted out of their wife was basically a kitchen appliance, just a compliant person who stayed in the kitchen and did what she was told. And so they put microchips in these women. That was the whole idea, right? So they didn't want a real relationship. They just wanted a sexy kitchen appliance, okay? Now, listen, if you come to God and you say, okay, God, I want you to forgive me, okay? I want you to, I want to believe in you that you created me. I want to believe in you so that my life is not without purpose, but I'm not going to adjust myself to your expectations. I'm not going to change myself for you. In fact, I'll just call on you. If you could just stay in the kitchen when I'm in trouble, I'll call on you. You don't have a real relationship with God. You've got a Stepford God. You've got a God that you've created for yourself. Do you have a God who can contradict you, right? When you actually encounter something in God's word that points out something in your life that, okay, this is what you say. Now, this is what I think. Sounds like you're telling me I'm wrong. I don't really like this feeling because I feel like I'm right. Do you have a God that you then surrender to, or do you do what the men of Stepford, Connecticut do and just say, well, I'm going to go ahead and put a microchip in you. I'm going to ignore you on that point. Because what you're doing in that place, you're saying, I want my autonomy. I want my independence from you. But what are you sacrificing? You're sacrificing a real relationship with God. If you don't have a God who can contradict you, you can't really say you have a real relationship with God. You've got a God of your imagination. Unless you come to God as he is, for all that he is, not as your personal assistant, not as a kitchen appliance to make your life better, but as the creator of the universe and the one holding it all together, then you're never gonna enjoy a real relationship with God where you know his steadfast love for you. But when you do come to God that way, when you encounter his love, what you will find is actually that you can trust this God. Even when you feel like he's confronting you, even when you don't quite understand where he's coming from, you see when you meet his love that you can trust him. That we can submit to his commands ultimately, not just because he created us and he's so powerful, not just because he's bigger than us and he's so wise, but ultimately we can submit to his commands because we know that he really loves us and his commands and rules and authority are not the harsh decrees of an angry tyrant, but they're the rules of a loving father. See, we can welcome God's authority only when we've experienced his love. When David says that the earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord, he's not speaking abstractly. He's talking about love that he and his people have experienced. This word steadfast love in the Hebrew is the word hesed. It has to do with God's covenant love for the people of Israel that David knew. It's the love that opened the Red Seas, right? That defied the laws of physics and said, let my people go. It's the love that sent manna from heaven and provided for his people in the wilderness. It's the love that was set on David when he was a little boy and overlooked by everybody else. And he said, I want you to be my king. You're my boy. It's this personal, intimate, covenant, steadfast love. And David has met it and he's encountered it. And he's saying, I look at you and what you've done for me, how you've loved me. And what can I do but receive your commandments with joy, knowing that you've got my best in mind, that you're there for my good. And our disobedience reveals that we haven't actually encountered what David encountered, right? We don't actually believe that God's love is as amazing as it really is, because if we did, we would gladly and joyfully come under his authority. I want to close with probably one of my favorite stories that Jesus tells, the parable of the prodigal son. Jesus tells this story. He says, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that's coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. You see what he did? He did what so many of us often do. He said, nobody can tell me how to live. Dad, give me my money. I'm gonna go live how I want, right? On my own terms, I'm gonna go be free. I'm gonna follow my heart. I'm gonna break away from tradition and the rules of my father. I'm gonna find the good life out there. But what happens? It says in verse 14, when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. So this son finds out quickly and harshly what many of us find out. There's no such thing as having no master. He throws off his father's rule. He ran from his father's authority, but he quickly finds himself under the thumb of a much worse master because sin is a tyrant. The freedom that he wanted so badly just turns into a new kind of bondage. And I just think that there's many of us here probably that feel trapped like he did. We're stuck in the muck, in the pig pen, and we don't know how to get out. We say, I've rejected God's, I've lived life on my own terms, and I don't know how to live any other way. And I feel like I'm stuck, and there's no way I can turn back to God after what I've done, after where I'm at now in life. I'm done. This whole sermon about God's commands, that's great, but what am I supposed to do now? I've never lived that way. I love what happens with this boy. It says when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have much more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. So he thinks, man, anything would be better than where I'm at now. I don't know that I fully trust my father's love for me. In fact, I think that probably if I go back, my father, he might make me a slave, probably punish me, but even that would be better than this life that I've created for myself. I can't do this anymore. But what happens when he goes back to his father? It says he arose and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son begins with his prepared speech. Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father says to him, no. He says to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found. And they began to celebrate. And no matter how far you've run from your creator, no matter how far you've run from the authority of God, you've tried to live life on your own terms, we have a God who runs out to wandering sinners. We have a God who is a father to the rebellious prodigals. The world says, follow your desires, right? Love yourself first, be true to yourself first. And that sounds good to us, but it leads to the pigsty. God says, deny yourself, surrender to my authority, be true to me first. And that sounds constraining and limiting, but that leads to the embrace of the creator that we were made for. Our God is not a cruel, punishing ogre. When we run back into his arms, when we say, okay, anything would be better than this, I don't know if I can trust him, I don't know what it's gonna be like, but I'm gonna give him a try. We find out that he's a father of mercy. And this was proved once and for all at the cross of Jesus Christ, that the God who formed us and created the world entered into his world, right? Talk about adjusting for the sake of someone you love. God adjusted, he became flesh to love us. But not only that, he went to a cross for us wandering sinners. None of us ever fully or perfectly obeys God's rule and authority. And rather than just obliterate us for it, he offered up himself for us. In the garden before the cross, Jesus prayed to his father, let this pain and sorrow pass from me, right? Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus embraced his father's authority in all of its pain so that he could give us life. He was nailed to a cross so that he couldn't even move. He chose to lay down his freedom to love us sacrificially so that we could know the ultimate freedom is in his embrace. We can trust his love. We can trust that even if we don't understand his commands, that the good life is not found out there away from God. It's only found in the Father's arms. So don't resist his rule over you. Surrender to it because you were made for it. In just a minute, we're gonna come to the communion table. And after we take communion together, we're gonna sing two songs, and the band can come up. But we're gonna sing I Surrender All, and then we're gonna sing Good, Good Father. Because I want us to first remind our hearts that to be a Christian is not just to believe certain things, it's to surrender our authority, to lay our lives down, to make him our master. But I also want us to be reminded that the one who is our master that we're surrendering to is our good, good Father. He's not a tyrant like so many of the other things that seek to enslave us. The one we serve served us first in the greatest way possible. We serve a God who first gave us himself. He gave us himself. When we come to the table, we come to his body broken for us. We come to his blood poured out for us for the forgiveness of our sins. How can we not now lay our life down for him? He laid his life down for us. No other master out there will lay down their lives for you like Jesus did. Let's pray.